good evening, boys and girls, and welcome to Reading with Rick. I'm so glad you could join me again tonight on a Thursday night. Did you have a good day? I went out for a drive and made it down to St. Cloud and back, and that was fun. And now we're settled in and ready to settle down for the night with a couple of really good stories tonight. Well, we're going to start with a story written by a man named Nathaniel Hawthorne. Now, he wrote a lot of things, and most of his writings were for older folks. As a matter of fact, some of his more famous books are called The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables, and a lot of schools and colleges use those books to teach classes. But he also wrote a couple of fables, and that's what we're going to have. One of his stories tonight, it's called The Golden Touch by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And then our second story tonight, remember we had the I Survived story about the Titanic maybe 2 weeks ago or so? Well, tonight Jack and Annie also find themselves on the Titanic. We'll see what happens to them. So, if you've been listening to Reading with Rick, you kind of know the story about the Titanic, but we'll see how Jack and Annie fare on the Titanic tonight when it comes to be their turn for their story on Reading with Rick. Okay, let's get started again. This is The Golden Touch by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Once upon a time, there lived a very rich king whose name was Midas. Besides all his money, he had a little daughter whom nobody but myself ever heard of, and whose name I either never knew or entirely forgot. So, because I love odd names for little girls, I choose to call her Marigold. Now, King Midas was fonder of gold than of anything else in the world. If he loved anything better or half so well, it was Marigold. But the more Midas loved his daughter, the more he desired and sought more wealth. He thought, foolish man, that the best thing he could possibly do for this dear child would be to give her the very largest pile of yellow glistening coins that he had ever accumulated, ever since the world was made. Thus, he gave all his thoughts and all his time to this one purpose. If ever he happened to gaze for an instant at the gold-tinted clouds of sunset, he wished that they were real gold and that they could be squeezed safely into his strong box. It was as though anything that was not gold was valueless in his eyes. And yet, in earlier days, before he was so entirely possessed of this insane desire for riches, King Midas had shown a great taste for flowers. He had planted a garden in which grew the biggest and sweetest, most beautiful roses that any mortal ever saw or smelled. These roses were still growing in the garden, as large, as lovely, and as fragrant as when Midas used to pass whole hours in gazing at them. But now, if he looked at them at all, it was only to calculate how much the garden would be worth if each of the innumerable rose petals were a thin plate of gold. And though he once was fond of music, the only music for poor Midas now was a chink of one coin against another. At length, as people always grow more and more foolish unless they take care to grow wiser and wiser, Midas became so exceedingly unreasonable that he could scarcely bear to see or touch any object that was not gold. He made it his custom, therefore, to pass a large portion of every day in a dark and dreary dungeon in the basement of his palace. It was here that he kept his wealth. To his dismal hold Midas took himself whenever he wanted to be particularly happy. Here, after carefully locking the door, he would take a bag of gold coins, or a gold cup as big as a washbowl, or a heavy golden bar, or a measure of gold dust, and bring it from the obscure corners of the room into the one bright and narrow sunbeam that fell from the dungeon window. He valued the sunbeam only because his treasure would not shine without its help. And then he could count the coins in the bag, toss up the bar and catch it as it came down, sift the gold dust through his fingers, look at the funny image of his own face as reflected in the burnished cup, and whisper to himself, "O Midas, rich King Midas, what a happy man art thou!" Midas called himself a happy man, but felt that he was not yet quite as happy as he might be. The very tip-top of enjoyment would never be reached until the whole world were to become his treasure room and be filled with yellow metal, which should be all his own. Now, I need hardly remind such wise little people as you are that in old days, when King Midas was alive, a great many things came to pass which we should consider wonderful if they were to happen in our own day and country. And on the other hand, a great many things take place nowadays which not only seem wonderful to us, but at which the people of old times would have stared their eyes out. Midas was enjoying himself in his treasure room one day when he perceived a shadow fall over the heaps of gold. Looking up, what should he behold but a figure of a stranger standing in the bright and narrow sunbeam? It was a young man with a cheerful and ruddy face. Perhaps it was his imagination, but he could not help fancying that the smile worn by the stranger had a kind of golden radiance in it. Certainly, although his figure intercepted the sunshine, there was now a brighter gleam upon all the piled-up treasures than before. Even the remotest corners were brightened when the stranger smiled, as with tips of flame and sparkles of fire. King Midas knew he'd carefully locked the chamber door and that no mortal could possibly break into his treasure room. Therefore, he concluded that his visitor must be something more than mortal. It is not important who he was. In those days, when the earth was comparatively a new affair, it supposedly was visited often by beings endowed with supernatural power and who used to interest themselves in the joys and sorrows of men, women, and children, half playfully and half seriously. Now, Midas had met such beings before, and was glad to meet one of them who seemed so good-humored and kindly. He guessed the visitor had come to do Midas a favor. And what could that favor be, unless to multiply his heaps of treasure? The stranger gazed about the room. When his lustrous smile had illuminated all the golden objects that were there, he turned again to Midas. "You are a wealthy man, friend Midas," he observed. "I doubt whether any other four walls on earth contain so much gold as you have piled up in this room." Midas answered in a discontented tone, "I have done pretty well, but after all, it's only a trifle when you consider that it has taken me my whole life to get it together. If one could live 1,000 years, one might truly have time to grow rich." "What?" exclaimed the stranger. "Then you are not satisfied?" Midas shook his head. "Out of curiosity," asked the visitor, "what would satisfy you?" Midas paused and meditated. He had a presentiment that this stranger, with such a golden luster in his good-humored smile, had come to him with both the power and the purpose of gratifying his utmost wishes. Now all he had to do was to speak in order to obtain his utmost desire, even the impossible. So he thought, and he thought, and he thought, and heaped one golden mountain upon another in his mind, without being able to imagine them big enough. At last, a bright idea occurred to King Midas. It seemed really as bright as the glistening metal which he loved so much. Raising his head, he looked the lustrous stranger in the face. "Well, Midas," observed his visitor, "I see that you have at length hit upon something that will satisfy you. Tell me your wish." Midas replied, "It is only this. I am weary of collecting my treasures with so much trouble and beholding the heap so slight, even after I've done my best. I wish everything that I touch to be changed to gold." The stranger's smile grew so broad that it seemed to fill the room like an outburst of the sun, and he exclaimed, "The golden touch! You certainly deserve credit, friend Midas, for striking on so brilliant a conception. But are you quite sure that this will satisfy you?" "How could it fail?" said Midas. "And will you never regret the possession of it?" Midas asked, "What could induce me? I ask nothing else to make me perfectly happy." Waving his hand in a token of farewell, the stranger replied, "Be it as you wish, then. Tomorrow at sunrise, you will find yourself gifted with the golden touch." The figure of the stranger then became exceedingly bright, and Midas involuntarily closed his eyes. On opening them again, he beheld only one yellow sunbeam in the room amidst the glistening of the precious metal which he had spent his life in hoarding up. Whether Midas slept as usual that night, the story does not say. Asleep or awake, however, his mind was probably in the state of a child's, to whom a beautiful new plaything had been promised in the morning. At any rate, day had hardly peeped over the hills when King Midas was wide awake, and stretching his arms out of the bed, began to touch the objects that were within his reach. He was anxious to see whether the golden touch had really come according to the stranger's promise. So he laid his finger on a chair by the bedside and on other various things, but was grievously disappointed to perceive that they remained of exactly the same substance as before. Indeed, he felt very much afraid that he had only dreamed about the lustrous stranger, or else that the latter had been playing with him. And what a miserable affair it would be if, after all his hopes, Midas must content himself with what little gold he could scrape together by ordinary means instead of creating it by a touch. All this while, it was only the gray of the morning, with but a streak of brightness along the edge of the sky where Midas could not see it. He lay there in a very disconsolate mood, regretting the downfall of his hopes, and kept growing sadder and sadder until the earliest sunbeam shone through the window and gilded the ceiling over his head. It seemed to Midas that this bright yellow sunbeam was reflected in rather a singular way on the white covering of the bed. Looking more closely, to his great astonishment and delight, he found this linen fabric had been transmuted to what seemed a woven texture of the purest and brightest gold. The golden touch had come to him with the first sunbeam. Midas started up in a kind of joyful frenzy and ran about the room, grasping at everything. He seized one of the bedposts, and it became immediately a fluted golden pillar. He pulled aside a window curtain, and the tassel grew heavy in his hand, a mass of gold. He took up a book from the table. At his first touch, it assumed the appearance of a splendidly bound and gilt-edged volume. Running his fingers through the leaves, behold, the book became a bundle of thin golden plates in which all the wisdom of the book had grown illegible. He hurriedly put on his clothes and was enraptured to see himself in a magnificent suit of gold cloth, which retained its flexibility and softness, although it burdened him a little with its weight. He drew out his handkerchief, which little Marigold had hemmed for him. That was likewise gold, with the dear child's neat and pretty stitches running all along the border in gold thread. Somehow or other, this last transformation did not quite please King Midas. He would rather that his little daughter's handiwork had remained just the same as when she'd climbed on his knee and put it into his hand. But it was not worth while to vex himself about a trifle. Midas now took his spectacles from his pocket and put them on his nose, in order that he might see more distinctly what he was about. In those days, spectacles for common people had not been invented, but they were already worn by kings, else how could Midas have had any? To his great perplexity, however, excellent as the glasses were, he discovered that he could not possibly see through them, for the transparent crystals turned out to be plates of yellow metal, and of course were worthless as spectacles. It struck Midas as rather inconvenient that now he could never again be rich enough to own a pair of serviceable spectacles. It is no great matter, nevertheless, he said to himself, very philosophically. We cannot expect any great good with some small inconvenience. The golden touch is worth the sacrifice of a pair of spectacles. My own eyes will serve for ordinary purposes, but little Marigold will soon be old enough to read to me. Wise King Midas was so exalted by his good fortune that the palace seemed not sufficiently spacious to contain him. He therefore went downstairs and smiled on observing that the banister became a bar of burnished gold as his hand passed over it. He lifted the door latch. It was brass only a moment ago, but golden when his fingers quitted it, and emerged into the garden. Here, as it happened, he found a great number of beautiful roses in full bloom, and others in all the stages of lovely bud and blossom. Very delicious was their fragrance in the morning breeze. Their delicate blush was one of the fairest sights in the world, so gentle, so modest, and so full of sweet tranquility did those roses seem to be. But Midas knew a way to make them far more precious than roses had ever been before. So he took great pains in going from bush to bush and exercised his magic touch until every individual flower and bud, and even the worms at the heart of some of them, were changed to gold. By the time this was completed, King Midas was summoned to breakfast. What was usually a king's breakfast in the days of Midas, I really do not know. To the best of my belief, however, on this particular morning, the breakfast consisted of hot cakes, some nice little brook trout, roasted potatoes, fresh boiled eggs, a coffee for King Midas himself, and a bowl of bread and milk for his daughter Marigold. At all events, this is a breakfast fit to set before a king. Little Marigold had not yet made her appearance. Her father ordered her to be called, and seating himself at the table, awaited the child's coming in order to begin his own breakfast. To do Midas justice, he really loved his daughter, and loved her so much the more this morning, because of the good fortune which had befallen him. Soon he heard her coming along the passageway, crying bitterly. This circumstance surprised him, because Marigold was one of the cheeriest little people you would see, and hardly shed a thimbleful of tears in a year. When Midas heard her sobs, he determined to put little Marigold into better spirits by an agreeable surprise. So, leaning across the table, he touched his daughter's bowl, which was a china one with pretty figures all around it, and transmuted it to gleaming gold. Meanwhile, Marigold slowly and disconsolately opened the door and showed herself with her apron at her eyes, still sobbing as if her heart would break. "My little lady," cried Midas, "what is the matter with you this bright morning?" Marigold, without taking the apron from her eyes, held out her hand, which held one of the roses Midas had so recently turned to gold. "Beautiful!" exclaimed her father, and "what is there in this magnificent golden rose to make you cry?" "Dear father," answered the child, as well as her sobs would let her, "it is not beautiful, but the ugliest flower that ever grew. As soon as I was dressed, I ran into the garden to gather some roses for you, because I know you like them. But, dear me, what do you think has happened? All the beautiful roses, which smelled so sweetly and had so many lovely blushes, are blighted and spoiled. They're grown quite yellow, as you see this one, and have no longer any fragrance. What's happened to them?" "Oh, my dear little girl, please don't cry about it," said Midas, who was ashamed to confess that he himself had brought the change which so greatly afflicted her. "Sit down and eat your bread and milk. You'll find it easy enough to exchange a golden rose like that, which will last hundreds of years, for an ordinary one which would wither in a day." "I don't care for such roses as this," cried Marigold, tossing it away. "It has no smell, and the hard petals sting my nose." The child now sat down to table, but was so occupied with her grief for the blighted roses that she did not even notice the wonderful china bowl. Perhaps this was all the better, for Marigold was accustomed to looking at the queer figures and strange trees and houses that were painted on the circumference of the bowl, and these ornaments were now entirely lost in the yellow hue of the metal. Midas, meanwhile, had poured out a cup of coffee, and, as a matter of course, the coffee pot whatever metal it may have been when he took it up, was gold when he set it down. He began to realize for the first time that this new power might be slightly inconvenient from time to time. If such things as the coffee pot turned to gold, the cupboard would be a secure place of deposit for such articles. Amid these thoughts, he lifted a spoonful of coffee to his lips and, sipping it instantly, was astonished to perceive that as his lips touched the liquid, it became molten gold and the next moment hardened into a lump. "Wah!" exclaimed Midas, rather aghast. "Father, what's the matter?" asked little Marigold, gazing at him with the tears still standing in her eyes. "Nothing, child, nothing," said Midas. "Drink your milk before it gets quite cold." He took one of the trouts on his plate and, by way of experiment, touched its tail with his finger. To his horror, it was immediately transmuted from an admirably fried brook trout into a goldfish, though not one of those goldfishes which people often keep in glass globes as ornaments for the parlor. No, it was really a metallic fish and looked as if it had been very cunningly made by the nicest goldsmith in the world. Its little bones were now golden wires. Its fins and tail were thin plates of gold, and there were the marks of the fork in it, and all the delicate frothy appearance of a nicely fried fish exactly imitated in metal. A very pretty piece of work, except King Midas would much rather have had a real trout in his dish than this elaborate and valuable imitation of one. He was growing hungrier by the moment. "I don't quite see," thought he to himself, "how am I to get any breakfast?" He took one of the smoking hot cakes and he had scarcely broken it when, to his cruel mortification, the white wheat assumed the yellow hue of Indian meal. Almost in despair, he helped himself to a boiled egg, which immediately underwent a change. "Well, this is a quandary," thought he, leaning back in his chair and looking quite enviously at little Marigold, who was now eating her bread and milk with great satisfaction. "Such a costly breakfast before me, and nothing that can be eaten." Hoping that by speed of hand he might avoid what he now felt to be a considerable inconvenience, King Midas next snatched a hot potato and attempted to cram it into his mouth and swallow it in a hurry. But the golden touch was too nimble for him. He found his mouthful not of mealy potato but of solid metal, which so burnt his tongue that he roared aloud and, jumping up from the table, began to dance and stamp about the room with both pain and fright. "Father, dear father," cried little Marigold, who was a very affectionate child, "what's the matter? Have you burnt your mouth?" "Oh, dear child," groaned Midas dolefully, "I don't know what it is to become of your poor father." "And truly, my dear little folks, did you ever hear of such a pitiable case? Here was literally the richest breakfast that could be set before a king, and its very richness made it absolutely good for nothing. The poorest laborer, sitting down to his crust of bread and cup of water, was far better off than King Midas, whose delicate food was really worth its weight in gold. But what was to be done? Already at breakfast, Midas was excessively hungry. Would he be less so by dinner time? And how ravenous would be his appetite for supper, which must undoubtedly consist of the same sort of indigestible dishes? How many days, do you think, would he survive on such a rich diet? These thoughts so troubled wise King Midas that he began to doubt whether, after all, riches are the one desirable thing in the world, or even the most desirable. But this was only a passing thought. So fascinated was Midas with the glitter of the yellow metal that he would still have refused to give up the golden touch for so paltry a consideration as a breakfast. Nevertheless, so great was his hunger and the perplexity of his situation that he again groaned aloud. Our pretty Marigold could endure it no longer. She sat a moment gazing at her father and trying with all the might of her little wits to find out what was the matter with him. Then, with a sweet and sorrowful impulse to comfort him, she started from her chair and, running to Midas, threw her arms affectionately about his knees. He bent down and kissed her, knowing full well that his little daughter's love was worth 1,000 times more than he had gained by the golden touch. "My precious, precious Marigold," cried he. But Marigold made no answer. Alas, what had he done? How fatal was the gift with which the stranger had bestowed? The moment the lips of Midas touched Marigold's forehead, a change had taken place. Her sweet, rosy face, so full of affection as it had been, assumed a glittering yellow color, with yellow teardrops congealing on her cheeks. Her beautiful brown ringlets took the same tint. Her soft and tender little form grew hard and inflexible within her father's encircling arms. Oh, terrible misfortune! The victim of his insatiable desire for wealth, little Marigold was a human child no longer, but now a golden statue. Yes, there she was, with the questioning look of love, grief, and pity hardened into her face. It was the prettiest and most woeful sight you would ever imagine. All the features and tokens of Marigold were there. Even the beloved little dimple remained in her golden chin. Midas began to wring his hands and bemoan himself. He could bear neither to look at Marigold nor to look away from her. Except when his eyes were fixed on the image, he could not possibly believe that she was changed to gold. But stealing another glance, there was the precious little figure with a yellow teardrop on its yellow cheek, and a look so piteous and tender. All Midas could do was to wring his hands, and to wish that he were the poorest man in the whole wide world, as if the loss of all his wealth might bring back the faintest rose color to his dear child's face. In the midst of his despair, he suddenly beheld a stranger standing near the door. Midas bent down his head without speaking, for he recognized the same figure which had appeared to him the day before in the treasure room, the one and only stranger who had bestowed on him this disastrous faculty of the golden touch. The stranger's countenance still wore a smile which seemed to shed a yellow luster all about the room. "Well, friend Midas," said the stranger, "how do you succeed with the golden touch?" Midas shook his head. "I am very miserable," said he. "Very miserable indeed," exclaimed the stranger. "And how does that happen? Have I not faithfully kept my promise with you? Have you not everything that your heart desired?" "Gold is not everything," answered Midas, "and I have lost all that my heart really cared for." "Ah, so you have made a discovery since yesterday," observed the stranger. "Let us see, then. Which of these two things do you think is really worth the most, the gift of the golden touch, or one cup of clear, cold water?" "Oh, blessed water," exclaimed Midas. "It will never moisten my parched throat again." "The golden touch," continued the stranger, "or a crust of bread?" "A piece of bread," answered Midas, "is worth all the gold on earth." "The golden touch," asked the stranger, "or your own little Marigold, warm, soft, and loving, as she was an hour ago?" "Oh, my child, my dear child," cried poor Midas, wringing his hands. "I would not have given that one small dimple in her chin for the power of changing this whole big earth into a solid lump of gold." The stranger, looking seriously at him, said, "You are wiser than you were, King Midas. Your own heart has not been entirely changed from flesh to gold. Were it so, your case would indeed be desperate. But you appear to be still capable of understanding that the commonest things, such as lie within everybody's grasp, are more valuable than the riches which so many mortals sigh over and struggle after. Tell me, do you sincerely desire to rid yourself of this golden touch?" "It is hateful to me," replied Midas. A fly settled on his nose, but immediately fell to the floor, for it, too, had become gold, and Midas shuddered. "Go, then," said the stranger, "and plunge into the river that glides past the bottom of your garden. Take likewise a vase of the same water and sprinkle it over any object that you may desire to change back again from gold into its former substance. If you do this in earnestness and sincerity, it may possibly repair the mischief which your greed has occasioned." King Midas bowed low, and when he lifted his head, the lustrous stranger had vanished. You will easily believe that Midas lost no time in snatching up a large pitcher, which immediately became gold, and hastened to the riverside. As he scampered along and forced his way through the shrubbery, it was positively marvelous to see how the foliage turned yellow behind him, as if the autumn had been there and nowhere else. On reaching the river's bank, he plunged headlong in without waiting so much as to pull off his shoes. "Whew, whew," snorted King Midas as his head emerged out of the water. "Well, this is really a refreshing bath, and I think it must have quite washed away the golden touch, and now for filling my pitcher." As he dipped the pitcher into the water, it gladdened his very heart to see it change from gold into the same good, honest earthen vessel which it had been before he touched it. He was conscious also of a change within himself. A cold, hard, and heavy weight seemed to have gone out of his bosom. No doubt, his heart had been gradually losing its human substance and transmuting itself into insensible metal, but had now softened again into flesh. Perceiving a violet that grew on the bank of the river, Midas touched it with his finger and was overjoyed to find that the delicate flower retained its purple hue instead of undergoing a yellow blight. The curse of the golden touch had, therefore, really been removed from him. King Midas hastened back to the palace, and I suppose the servants knew not what to make of it when they saw their royal master so carefully bringing home an earthen pitcher of water. But that water, which was to undo all the mischief that his folly had wrought, was more precious to Midas than an ocean of molten gold could have been. The first thing he did, as you need hardly be told, was to sprinkle it by handfuls over the golden figure of little Marigold. No sooner did it fall on her than you would have laughed to see how the rosy color came back to the dear child's cheek, and how she began to sneeze and sputter. How astonished she was to find herself dripping wet, and her father still throwing more water over her. "Please, father," she cried, "see how you wet my nice frock, and which I put on only this morning." For Marigold did not know she had been a little golden statue, nor could she remember anything that had happened since the moment when she ran with outstretched arms to comfort poor King Midas. Her father did not think it necessary to tell his beloved child how very foolish he had been, but contented himself with showing how much wiser he had now grown. For this purpose, he led little Marigold into the garden, where he sprinkled all the remainder of the water over the rose bushes, and with such good effect that more than 5,000 roses recovered their beautiful bloom. There were two circumstances, however, which, as long as he lived, used to remind King Midas of the golden touch. One was that the sands of the river sparkled like gold. The other, that little Marigold's hair had now a golden tinge, which he had never observed in it before she had been transformed by the effect of his kiss. This change of hue was really an improvement and made Marigold's hair richer than in her babyhood. When King Midas had grown quite an old man and used to bounce Marigold's children on his knee, he was fond of telling them this marvelous story, pretty much as I have now told it to you. Then he would stroke their glossy ringlets and tell them that their hair, likewise, had a rich shade of gold, which they inherited from their mother. "And to tell you the truth, my precious little folks," said King Midas, "ever since that morning I have hated the very sight of all other gold except this." And that's the end of A Touch of Gold, the story of King Midas by Nathaniel Hawthorne. So, that's a classic story, the story of King Midas and the Golden Touch, and we're going to go take our little break now, and when we come back, we'll go with Jack and Annie in the Magic Treehouse and see how they fare on the Titanic. Tonight's story, the Magic Treehouse, tonight on the Titanic, when we come back on Reading with Rick. So those of you headed off to bed, snuggle in tight and have sweet dreams, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you. Okay, we are back and ready for our next adventure with Jack and Annie in the Magic Treehouse. So let's get started with tonight's adventure. One day in Frog Creek, Pennsylvania, a mysterious treehouse appeared in the woods. 8-year-old Jack and his 7-year-old sister Annie climbed into the treehouse and found that it was filled with books. Jack and Annie soon discovered that the treehouse was magic. It could take them to the places in the books. All they had to do was point to a picture and wish to go there. Along the way, they discovered that the treehouse belonged to Morgan Le Fay. Morgan is a magical librarian from the time of King Arthur. She travels through time and space gathering books. In their adventure so far, Jack and Annie helped free Morgan from a spell. They've also helped solve 4 ancient riddles to become master librarians, and they've saved 4 ancient stories from being lost forever. And now they're set to begin a new set of adventures. Jack opened his eyes. It was a stormy night. The rain tapped hard on his window pane. "Do you hear what the rain is saying?" said a voice, and Jack turned on his lamp. Annie stood in his doorway. She wore her rain poncho over her pajamas and held a flashlight. "It's saying, come on now."
"You're nuts," said Jack.
"Listen, just listen," said Annie. And Jack listened. The rain did seem to be tapping out. "Come now, come now. We have to go to the treehouse," said Annie. "Something important is about to happen."
"Now?" said Jack.
Jack didn't want to leave his warm, cozy room, but he had a feeling Annie was right. Something important was about to happen.
"You coming?" she said.
Yeah, he said, and he climbed out of bed.
"Just put on your rain poncho," said Annie.
Jack threw his rain poncho over his pajamas. He pulled on his sneakers and grabbed his backpack.
"Don't forget your master librarian card," said Annie. "I have mine with me."
Jack put the card with the glowing letters ML on it into his backpack. "I'm ready," he said. Jack and Annie went quietly down the stairs. Then they slipped out the door and into the chilly, damp night. The storm had eased up. Rain fell gently as they ran up the street. The wet ground glistened in the beam of the flashlight. They headed into the Frog Creek woods. Wind blew through the trees, shaking water to the ground. Jack shivered, and he wiped raindrops off his glasses.
"Brr," said Annie. "I'm cold."
"Me too," said Jack. As they kept walking, Annie pointed the flashlight up into the trees.
"There it is," she said. Her light had found the treehouse. "Morgan," Jack called, and there was no answer.
"I wonder what's wrong," said Annie. "I was sure she'd be here."
"Let's go up and see," said Jack.
Annie grabbed the rope ladder and started climbing, and Jack followed. Rain dripped from the trees onto his poncho. They climbed into the treehouse. Annie shined her light into each corner. The first 3 corners were empty. Then the flashlight hit the 4th. Jack and Annie gasped with surprise. Sitting in the corner was a small dog. He looked like a terrier puppy. He had scruffy, light brown fur. He stared sadly at Jack and Annie.
"Oh," whispered Annie.
"Where did you come from?" said Jack. Annie patted the dog's head. He wagged his tail.
"He's so cute," she said. "He looks like a little teddy bear. Hi, Teddy."
Teddy was actually a good name for him, Jack thought.
"Where did you come from, Teddy?" he asked, and the little dog whimpered.
"Don't be sad," said Annie. "Everything's okay."
"How did he get up here?" Jack asked.
"I don't know, but I bet Morgan had something to do with it," said Annie. Jack's eyes fell on a piece of paper lying on the floor.
"I think you're right," he said.
He picked up the paper. On it was fancy writing, and it said, "This little dog is under a spell and needs your help. To free him, you must be given 4 special things: a gift from a ship lost at sea, a gift from the prairie blue, a gift from a forest far away, a gift from a kangaroo. Be wise, be brave, be careful. Morgan. P.S. Your master librarian cards won't help on this mission. Just be yourselves, and all will be well."
"What kind of spell do you think Teddy is under?" said Annie.
"Who knows?" said Jack.
"Poor thing," said Annie, and she patted the dog's head, and he licked her hand.
"It looks like we have to take 4 trips," said Jack. Teddy trotted over to a book. He pushed it with his nose.
"Look," said Annie, "I bet that will take us on the first trip." She picked up the book that the little dog had chosen. "Good job, Teddy," she said. The title of the book was The Unsinkable Ship. "Well, at least that's good," said Jack. "The ship won't sink, even if it is lost." "Ready, Teddy?" asked Annie.
"Arf, arf,"
he answered. Jack pointed at the cover of the book. "I wish we could go there," he said, and the wind started to blow, and the treehouse started to spin, and then it spun faster and faster. And then everything was still, absolutely still.
"Arf, arf!"
Jack opened his eyes. He shivered. Wherever they were now, it was cold, very cold. Teddy barked again. "Shh," said Jack. Annie shined the flashlight on her clothes. "Wow, we're dressed like old-fashioned kids," she said. Instead of pajamas and a poncho, she wore a sailor dress and a long wool cloak. Jack had on an overcoat and knee-length pants with long socks. His backpack had turned to leather. He also had on a shirt and tie. "Where are we?" he wondered aloud. Jack and Annie looked out the window. The moonless sky glittered with stars. There was a soft wind and the sound of water lapping. The treehouse seemed to be resting on a wooden deck between two giant columns. Jack looked up and saw smoke coming out of the columns. "We must have landed on the ship between the smokestacks," he said. Then Jack looked straight ahead and saw a box high in the air near the front of the ship. "That must be the lookout's nest," he said. Jack sat back in the treehouse and opened their book. Annie handed him the flashlight. "Let's find out where we are," he said. He turned to a picture of a huge ocean liner. By the light of the flashlight, he read, "Late at night on April 14th, 1912, an English ocean liner was making her first voyage across the Atlantic Ocean. She was going to New York City, carrying 2,200 passengers. The ship was four city blocks long. Most people believed the ship was unsinkable." "Oh, man, we're in 1912, said Jack, and he pulled out his notebook and wrote, "April 14th, 1912. "This ship is huge," said Annie. "How will we ever find the gift to help free Teddy?" "We can't go looking for a gift," said Jack. "You have to wait until someone gives it to you." "Right," said Annie with a sigh. "Well, I guess we just have to be ourselves, like Morgan said. Maybe we'll get lucky." "This is hard," said Jack, and the little dog whined. "Don't worry, Teddy," said Annie. "We'll free you from your spell." Just then, a shout came from the lookout's nest. "Iceberg ahead!" Jack and Annie turned back to the window just in time to see a huge iceberg looming out of the sea. The iceberg was dark with a fringe of white at the top, and it was right in front of the ship. Jack felt a jolt, then he heard a grinding sound. The ship was scraping against the mountain of ice.
"Arf! Arf!"
Teddy barked. "Shh, don't be scared," said Annie. She picked the dog up and hugged him. The scraping sound stopped. The ship slid past the iceberg until they lost sight of it. The night was calm again. "See," Annie said to Teddy, "it was just a little bump. This ship is unsinkable." But Jack was worried. "Wait, I have to read more about this," he said. "Don't read now, Jack," said Annie. "It's time to get the gift. Come on, Teddy." She picked up the little dog and the flashlight. She climbed out the treehouse window. "Hey, don't take the flashlight," said Jack. But Annie was gone. "Annie!" called Jack. He heard a soft, "Yikes!" Annie stuck her head back in the treehouse. "Bad news," she said in a whisper. "I think you'd better see this." Jack threw his stuff into his knapsack. He put it on and climbed out the window. Annie was standing by the ship's railing, holding Teddy. Without a word, she shined the flashlight on a life preserver hanging from the railing. In big black letters were the words, "RMS Titanic." Jack stared at the name of the ship. "You know what happened to the Titanic, don't you?" he said softly, and Annie nodded. "It hit an iceberg and sank," she said, "but I don't get it. I thought this ship was unsinkable." "That's what people thought when the Titanic was built," said Jack, "but they were wrong." Suddenly, steam gushed out of the ship's smokestacks. Then the engines cut off. The Titanic stopped moving. "We'd better go home," said Jack. "There's nothing we can do here. We'll have to find another lost ship, a safer one." "No, we have to stay and help," said Annie. "We can escape in the treehouse any time we want." "But what can we do?" said Jack. "This ship's going to sink no matter what. We can't change history, and we can't take anyone into our time with us."
"Yeah, but maybe there's some way we can help," said Annie.
"How?" said Jack.
"I don't know," said Annie. "Let's look around."
Holding Teddy, she disappeared down a small stairway. Jack followed her to a lower level. Annie put Teddy down on the deck. The dog sniffed the chunks of ice that had fallen off the iceberg. The ship seemed strangely empty.
"Where is everyone?" Annie asked.
"Maybe they're still asleep," said Jack. "They probably don't even know the ship hit something." Annie and Jack started toward the front of the Titanic.
"Come on, Teddy," said Annie, and the little dog scampered after them.
They passed the round windows of different rooms on the ship. Jack looked through them as he went by. He saw exercise bikes and rowing machines in one room. In another, there were palm trees, bamboo chairs, and tables. Next, they passed a library filled with books.
"This ship is like a town," said Jack.
Near the end of the deck, they peeked through another round window. Inside a little room, a man was wearing earphones. Jack heard a clicking noise as the man tapped a lever on a black box.
"What's he doing?" whispered Annie.
Jack shrugged. Another man stood nearby. He had a white beard and wore a fancy uniform.
"Send the international call for help," he ordered the man with headphones. "Tell all ships close by to come at once. We're sinking."
"Yes, Captain," said the man.
"Great, they're calling for help," Annie whispered.
Jack shook his head. "I don't think help will come," he said. He shined the flashlight on the book and found a picture of the radio operator. He read quietly to Annie. After the Titanic hit the iceberg at 11:40 p.m., the ship's radio operator sent out an SOS. An SOS is the International Distress Signal in Morse code. Unfortunately, the only ship near the Titanic had turned off its radio for the night. All the other ships who received the message were too far away to help. When the Titanic sank around 2:20 a.m., she was all alone.
"That's terrible," said Annie.
"I wonder what time it is now," said Jack.
"I don't know," said Annie.
Jack pulled out his notebook and wrote, "SOS sent out, Titanic sinks at 2:20 a.m.
"He's leaving," whispered Annie.
"Hide," whispered Jack. He and Annie moved quickly into the shadows. The captain stepped out onto the deck.
"Tell the men to start loading the lifeboats now," the captain ordered a deckhand.
"Yes, Captain," the man answered.
The captain and the deckhand left. Annie turned to Jack.
"At least that's good," she whispered. "Everyone can get into the lifeboats."
"I don't think it's good enough," said Jack, and he read from the book again. On the Titanic, there were 20 lifeboats. To save all the passengers, the ship needed twice as many. But with all the confusion on board, a number of the lifeboats were not even full when they left the ship. Many third-class passengers did not have a chance to get into any of the lifeboats because they were on the lower decks and didn't know where to go. Jack wrote in his notebook, "Need twice as many lifeboats."
"Hey, I know what we can do to help," said Annie.
"What?" asked Jack.
"We can help someone find the lifeboat," she said.
"You're right," said Jack. "With our book, we can find our way to a lower deck." He turned the page to a map of the ship. He and Annie studied it.
"We'll start at the grand stairway," said Jack. He traced a path with his finger.
"Then we'll go down to the third-class cabins this way."
"Good plan," said Annie.
Jack looked back through the door. The radio operator was still tapping out his message over and over and over.
"SOS," whispered Jack.
He took a deep breath.
"Okay," he said, "let's go."
Jack and Annie slipped through a door off the boat deck. Teddy was at their heels.
"Wow," breathed Annie.
"Arf, arf,"
Teddy barked.
They were at the top of the empty grand stairway. It was beautiful. It was made of dark, glossy wood. A huge dome with lights hung above it.
At the top of the stairs was a fancy clock. The hands of the clock were at 12:20.
"Oh, man, it's 20 minutes after midnight," said Jack. "The ship's going down in 2 hours.
They hurried down the carpeted steps and into the first-class hallway. Teddy followed along. Jack looked at the map in the book.
"These are the staterooms," he said. "This hall will take us to the third-class open deck."
"Hey, look," said Annie. "The floor is slanting down."
Jack caught his breath. She was right.
"That means the front of the ship is already sinking," he said.
And just then, a man in a white uniform came down the hall. He knocked on the doors.
"Put on your life belts at once and come up to the boat deck," he called.
Men and women stumbled out of their rooms. They wore elegant robes made of shiny cloth and velvet.
"What's going on?" a woman asked. "There's been a little accident," the man in the uniform said cheerfully.
"Oh, how silly," said the woman.
"It's not silly," said Annie. "Do what he says."
"Arf, arf,"
Teddy barked as if he was agreeing with Annie.
"Shh, Teddy," said Jack. He picked up the little dog. Then he and Annie hurried down the hall. They crossed the third-class open deck where more people were standing. These people were not dressed in fancy clothes. They mostly wore plain dark coats. They didn't seem worried either. They were all joking and laughing. Jack and Annie slipped through the crowd. They went into a big smoky room. Four men were playing cards. A woman played the piano. A young couple danced to the music.
"Put on your life belts and go up to the boat deck," Annie shouted.
The people looked at Annie in surprise. The card player smiled at her. She opened her mouth to yell again, but Jack pulled her out of the door.
"Come on," he said. "We have to get down to the third-class cabins before it's too late."
They hurried down another hall. Then they climbed down another stairway. Jack carried Teddy the whole way. At the bottom of the stairs, they rounded a corner, and they both gasped. The floor was really slanting down here, and water sloshed at the end of a hallway.
"The Titanic is sinking," said Jack.
"But no one understands," said Annie.
"I know," said Jack. It made him feel terribly sad.
Teddy whined. Jack buried his face in the little dog's fur.
"Come on," said Annie, and she began banging on the cabin doors.
The doors swung open. The cabins were all empty.
"The people from this hallway must be the ones up near the lounge," said Jack. "Maybe we should go down to a lower deck."
He started to walk back to the stairs, but Teddy began barking furiously.
"What's wrong with him?" said Jack.
"I don't know," said Annie. Suddenly, the dog leaped out of Jack's arms and charged down the hall. He was running straight toward the water.
"Watch out!" cried Jack.
He and Annie ran after Teddy. The dog began barking at a closed door. The door opened, and a very small boy peeked out. The boy wore a nightshirt. He had red hair and freckles. He looked about 4 years old. He rubbed his eyes sleepily. Then he saw Teddy.
"Puppy," he said with a huge smile.
He threw his arms around the little dog's neck, and Teddy licked his face.
"Come back to bed, William," a voice called from inside the room.
"Come out," Annie shouted. "It's an emergency."
A moment later, the door opened wider. A girl in a long white nightgown peeked out. She had red hair and freckles, too. She was tall and thin. She looked to be about 12 or 13 years old.
"Hello," she said. She put her arm around the little boy. "I'm Lucy O'Malley. This is my brother William."
"I'm Annie," said Annie, "and this is my brother Jack."
"Get your parents and tell them to come with us," said Jack.
Lucy looked confused.
"Our parents aren't here. They're in New York," she said. "We're on our way to them."
"Listen, the Titanic has hit an iceberg," said Annie. "We'll take you to a lifeboat."
"What do you mean?" said Lucy.
"The ship's sinking," said Annie. "Look!"
And she pointed to the water at the end of the hall.
"Oh, no!" cried Lucy.
"Don't be afraid," said Jack. "Just get your coats and your life belts. We don't have much time."
Lucy nodded. Then she went back inside in the room and came out with their things. Lucy pulled on her coat and her life belt. Annie helped William put on his.
"Let's go," said Jack.
"Wait, can Teddy fit in your knapsack?" said Annie.
"Try," said Jack.
Annie slipped the little dog into the leather knapsack on Jack's back. Only Teddy's front paws and head stuck out.
"Stay there, honey," said Annie.
She kissed Teddy on the nose. Jack didn't feel any extra weight in his knapsack. The little dog felt as light as air.
"Wait, I forgot something," said Lucy.
"We don't have time," started Jack, but Lucy rushed back into the room.
"Hurry," shouted Annie.
When Lucy came out, Jack saw her slip something into her coat pocket. Then she grabbed William's hand.
"Ready?" said Jack.
Suddenly, he felt freezing water brush against his shoes, and he looked down. The green seawater was slowly moving down the hall.
"Arf! Arf!"
barked Teddy from Jack's pack.
"Run!" cried Annie.
Annie led everyone down the hall to the stairs, away from the cold seawater. As she and Lucy helped William up the stairs, Jack and Teddy followed. Halfway up the staircase, Teddy let out a yelp, and Jack looked back. The water was creeping up the stairs step by step.
"Come on, Jack!" Annie shouted.
Jack ran up the rest of the stairs. He and Annie led William and Lucy through the smoky room. The men were still playing cards.
"To the lifeboats!" Annie yelled at the card players. "Right now! Hurry!"
And the men just smiled at her again.
"Little girl," one said with a laugh, "even if this ship does sink, it will take all night. There's plenty of time for everyone on board to be rescued."
"Indeed, many ships are on their way right now," another man said in a soothing voice. "There's nothing to worry about."
"Not true," said Annie.
Lucy turned to Jack.
"This doesn't sound so bad after all," she said.
"It is bad. Please, trust me," said Jack. "We have to keep going."
They went outside. The crowd on the third-class deck had grown. Many wore life belts, but no one here seemed very worried yet. Jack and Annie pulled Lucy and William along. They hurried through the crowd and down the first-class hall. They came to the end and trooped up the grand staircase. On the top deck, the Titanic was as bright as a Christmas tree. A band played lively music. With a hiss and rush of light, a rocket streaked into the sky, and it made a loud boom. Then it burst into many colored balls. Shivering in the cold, William laughed and clapped.
"Fireworks," he said.
Lucy smiled at Jack and Annie.
"This is a trick, isn't it?" she said. "You brought us to a party."
"No, it isn't," said Jack. "Don't you remember the water downstairs?"
And Lucy's smile faded.
"Women and children first," someone shouted.
"That's you," said Annie. "Come on."
She pulled Lucy and William toward a lifeboat.
The lifeboat was waiting to go down. It looked tiny as it swung on cables at the side of the big ship. The water below deck looked black.
"Get in, get in," a uniformed man shouted.
"No, no," said William, and he hit his face against Lucy's coat, and Lucy was shaking her head.
"I'd rather stay here," she said to Jack and Annie.
Jack understood. The brightly lit Titanic seemed so solid and safe compared to the little lifeboat.
"You can't stay here," said Annie. "The Titanic is going to sink soon, very soon," said Jack.
Lucy kept shaking her head, and Jack saw tears in her eyes.
"Lucy, we're telling the truth," said Jack. "You and William are in great danger."
"You have to be brave now," said Annie, "for your brother's sake."
Lucy straightened up and tried to smile.
"All right," she said, "I will."
"This way," a man called. "Women and children, this way, you four."
And he pointed at them.
"Get in," said Jack.
He gently pushed Lucy and William forward.
"Goodbye, Lucy," said Annie. "Goodbye, William."
Lucy looked surprised. "You're not coming?" she asked.
"No, we're going home another way," said Annie.
"Oh, dear," said Lucy. "I hope you'll be safe."
"We will. Don't worry," said Jack.
"Wait," said Lucy. And she reached into her coat pocket and pulled out a silver watch on a chain.
"This is a gift for both of you," she said. "It's our father's watch. We carried it on the voyage for good luck. I have a feeling that the two of you were our good luck tonight."
Jack looked at the watch as Lucy put it around Annie's neck.
The time on the watch was 1:50. There were only 30 minutes left.
"Hurry, hurry," he said.
Jack and Annie watched as a big man picked Lucy up and swung her into the little boat. Then he picked William up and put him in Lucy's lap.
"Bye," cried Annie, and she stepped forward to blow a kiss.
Just then, the man picked Annie up.
"No," shouted Annie.
"Into the lifeboat, my dear," the man said, and he tossed Annie into the lifeboat.
"No, no," cried Jack. And then the man reached for him, too.
Jack jumped away just in time.
"Annie," he yelled, "get out."
Annie tried to climb out of the lifeboat.
"Let me out," she cried.
"Arf, arf,"
Teddy barked from over Jack's shoulder. The lifeboat jerked. It started creaking down toward the dark, cold sea.
"Come back," Jack called.
But there was nothing he could do as Annie disappeared from sight.
"Annie," cried Jack. "Let me out," he heard Annie shout.
But the lifeboat kept going down.
"Wait for me," came a loud voice. "Wait for me."
A woman in a fur coat appeared at the railing. She nearly threw herself over the side of the ship.
"Stop," the uniformed man called. "Bring the boat back up for Lady Blackwell."
Slowly the lifeboat was brought back up. Jack pushed his way forward. The lifeboat came even with the ship. Jack reached out to Annie and she grabbed his hands. He pulled her back onto the sinking ship.
"Room for one more," Annie shouted to Lady Blackwell. Then she and Jack took off before anyone could catch them.
They ran up the slanting deck. Annie stopped and peered over the railing. Jack looked too. They saw Lucy and William's little lifeboat creaking down toward the Atlantic Ocean. It reached the glassy black water, then it floated off into the darkness, and Annie waved.
"Bye, William! Bye, Lucy!" she shouted. "Thanks for your gift!"
She held up the watch that hung from her neck. Then she and Jack looked at it. The time was
2:05. Only 15 minutes left, said Annie. We have to get back to the treehouse now, said Jack. Let's climb the stairs to the smokestacks. Suddenly, the front of the ship dipped down into the sea. Deck chairs started to slide past Jack and Annie. The band played a slow, calm song. It sounded like a church hymn. But the crowd started to panic. People pushed and shouted, trying to get to a safer part of the ship.
It's every man for himself, the captain shouted to all of his crew.
The men all stopped what they were doing and ran up the deck. Jack and Annie ran too, dodging sliding tables and chairs. They reached the stairs that led to the smokestacks. They grabbed the railing and pulled themselves up the steps. The ship tilted further.
Get to those smokestacks, cried Jack.
They slipped and crawled down the deck. But when they got to the smokestacks, Jack and Annie looked around wildly. The magic treehouse was gone.
Where is it? Shouted Annie.
The front of the Titanic sank deeper into the sea. Jack and Annie fell forward. They grabbed the railing and held on for their lives.
Maybe the treehouse fell into the ocean, shouted Jack.
And a great roar started coming from the ship. Jack imagined everything crashing forward. All the furniture, dishes, bicycles, the grand clock on the staircase. He looked down. A giant wave of water rolled over a lower deck. Jack imagined water flooding the third-class corridor, the card room, and the grand staircase. He closed his eyes, waiting to be washed away.
Arf! Arf!
The barking came from a distance. Teddy! Cried Annie. Jack had all forgotten about the little dog. Holding onto the railing, he used one hand to pull off his knapsack. Teddy wasn't there. There was more frantic barking.
Where's Teddy? Cried Jack.
He's calling us, shouted Annie.
We can't look for him, shouted Jack. We'll fall off the ship.
Teddy barked and barked.
He's close by, said Annie.
She held onto the railing and moved slowly down the steep deck.
Annie, cried Jack.
And suddenly the lights on the Titanic went out. The world was pitch dark. Jack couldn't see Annie at all.
Annie, he shouted.
He tried to move down the deck, too, but the ship tilted again, and Jack slipped and fell. He rolled until he crashed into a smokestack.
Jack, cried Annie, here, here.
Teddy kept barking. The back of the Titanic was rising out of the ocean. The front of the ship was going down. Jack tried to go around the smokestack without falling. In the dark, he could barely see the treehouse. It was stuck between a smokestack and the railing, and it was lying on its side. Annie and Teddy were looking out the window.
Teddy's barking led me here, cried Annie. Hurry, Jack.
Jack crawled around the smokestack. He held out his hand, and Annie grabbed it. She pulled him into the treehouse, and Teddy licked his face.
I wish we could go home, shouted Annie, pointing at the Pennsylvania book.
Jack heard a loud crack, and the wind started to blow, and the treehouse started to spin, and it spun faster and faster. And then everything was still, absolutely still.
Oh, man, whispered Jack.
He was lying on the floor of the treehouse. He was wearing his pajamas and rain poncho again.
You okay? Annie asked.
Yeah, you, said Jack.
My heart's beating really fast, said Annie.
Mine too, said Jack. He thought of the Titanic sinking into the cold black sea. His eyes filled with tears.
It was terrible, he said.
Annie nodded. Jack could see tears on her cheeks. Teddy licked Jack's face.
Hey, said Jack, how did you get out of my knapsack?
Teddy whined. Jack and Annie stroked his furry head and ears.
I think he has a touch of magic, said Annie.
Slowly, Jack sat up. He saved our lives, he said. And now we have the first gift to break the spell he's under, said Annie. She turned on her flashlight. She shined it on the silver pocket watch that hung from her neck. Lucy's gift, she said. The watch had stopped. The hands were at 2:20. Jack was silent. Then he sighed.
That's exactly when the ship went down, he said.
Annie looked at him. I guess that's when time stopped for the Titanic, she said. Jack nodded. Annie put the pocket watch on top of Morgan's note. A gift from a ship lost at sea, she said softly. They were both quiet. Then Jack took off his glasses and wiped the tears from his eyes. Annie stood up, and she took a deep breath.
"I'm ready to go," she said. "Let's put Teddy in your pack and take him home with us." She shined her flashlight around the treehouse. "Teddy?" There was no sign of the little dog. "He's not here," said Annie. "What are you talking about?" said Jack. "We were just petting him." "He's up to his magic tricks again," said Annie, and she sighed. "We'll have to go home without him." "But what happened to him?" said Jack. "I don't know," said Annie, "but I have a feeling we'll see him again soon." She started down the rope ladder, and Jack looked around the treehouse one last time. "Teddy?" he said. But the treehouse was quiet. Jack pulled on his backpack and climbed down the rope ladder, and Annie was there waiting for him. Without a word, Jack took her hand. The rain had stopped, but water still dripped from the trees. Stars glittered overhead in a clear sky. Silently, Jack and Annie left the Frog Creek woods. They walked up the dark street to their house and climbed the steps to their porch. Before they went inside, they looked out again at the night. "Time might have stopped for the Titanic," Jack said, "but books and memories keep the Titanic alive, don't they? It's a true story, but it's also like a myth now." "Yeah," said Annie, "and every time the story's told, we wish it had a different ending." Jack nodded. That was exactly how he felt. Staring at the starry sky, he shuddered at the memory of the sinking ship. He knew that he and Annie were lucky. They'd come home. "Good night, Titanic," he said softly. "Goodbye." Then he and Annie slipped quietly into their house, where it was cozy and dry and very safe. And that's the end. They made it off the Titanic and back to the magic treehouse. So they found the first gift from a lost ship, that watch. I wonder where they go tomorrow night. We're going to find out. No, we won't. Tomorrow night's a different night. Tonight's our big people story, isn't it? So we'll have to wait till Monday to find out where they go to on their next adventure. What did Morgan? Well, remember, the first was a gift from a ship lost at sea, and they got that, the watch. The next gift they have to find is a gift from the Prairie Blue. We'll have to think about that over the weekend and wonder where Jack and Annie wind up after getting back to the Magic Treehouse. So we'll find out on Monday, and we'll come back with another story tomorrow night as well as we wrap up our week with a Friday night reading with Rick. So good night, everybody, and thanks for listening again.